So welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Mediaship, along with Rafat Ali in New York. How are things there?
Hi, Mark. Things are going well. Today is the first cold day of the winter. It was in 30s, upper 30s in the morning, and it's probably in the 40s now, and it's kind of cold. It's a very clear day, but we're all looking forward to it.
Yeah, winter. It's one of those times, I guess, where just things slow down in general. Life kind of slows down. The news slows down. Media people kind of take breaks here and there. There's a lot of vacations and things, so it's kind of a mellow time of year, I guess.
It is. I mean, to the extent that today Twitter relaunching their website, and that's going to be the biggest news, I'm guessing, for the next like 5 weeks or something.
Yeah, did you notice? I mean, it was hard to see that there was a lot different. It looked like they just kind of rearranged the page a little bit.
The tiles and stuff.
I wonder if this is kind of a beginning of where they might start putting ads or something in.
Yeah, I think they're trying to make it more content-rich page for each, as if you go on the website to your profile or whatever your dashboard is. They're trying to make it more meaningful than just the flowing stream. I think that's. I haven't looked at it closely enough. It was just news breaking as we're doing the show.
Yeah, and the business pages now are going to be more like, I guess, a Facebook brand page is what I've heard as well.
Yeah, I saw that headline. I haven't read into it, but yeah, I guess it's high time they did that.
Yeah, maybe we can do. And now Facebook is kind of finally getting its timelines out, so maybe we can do a show maybe in the future and just talk about kind of the new revamped Facebook, revamped Twitter, what it means for us.
Yeah, or we could do a brand existing on Twitter versus Facebook versus Google Plus, because everybody's not trying to create brand pages, right, on these three main networks, and I'm sure Instagram will have something or other people have something, so we could do a show focused on that too.
Yeah, because everyone wonders where to put all their time and energy, for sure.
Yeah.
So for this show, we have a couple good guests on, and we'll have a little bit of a holiday theme too later on. But we'll be talking to Jeff Roberts from Paid Content. We'll be on. He's been at the UBS Media Conference in New York, and he can talk about. There's a lot going on there around Netflix CEO is there, Time Warner CEO, News Corp, a bunch of other kind of media bosses. A lot of talk about over-the-top TV and video services like Netflix. Verizon might have their own Netflix competitor, etc. So we'll talk to Jeff about that. And also, Jeff has been covering, there's a growing amount of investigations into ebooks price fixing that's gone on around Apple. And some of the bigger book publishers, we might have even talked about that before, about this kind of push for an agency model and making sure that ebooks have kind of inflated prices versus Amazon's $9.99 price. And then finally, we'll have on Brian Lamb, who runs Wirecutter, and he's done this great holiday gadget guide. And so we'll kind of give him the third degree as far as what are the best gifts for our friends and family and for your own friends and family, and just, you know, find out what his tips are. So first, let's start with the UBS Media Conference that's happening in New York this week. Netflix CEO Reed Hastings kind of came on and gave these kind of mea culpas about how, you know, it's been a rough few months for Netflix. They raised their rates. They tried to start this Quickster thing that didn't really get off the ground, and he's kind of coming out and saying, look, we made some mistakes, but, you know, the stock has been hammered, down 74% this year, but he's, you know, he admits they were overconfident and is now saying that Netflix is really trying to be more like HBO with original content and things like that. And then the Time Warner CEO Jeff Bukes kind of came on, and him and people at HBO have had a lot of negative things to say about Netflix, and this time Buke said that Netflix is our friend. So we're not sure exactly what's going on there. I know they made a deal for some TV content, but it's kind of an interesting talks by a lot of these media execs. Let's bring on Jeff Roberts and see what he has to say. Jeff Roberts is the legal reporter for The Guardian's Paid Content. He previously worked for Reuters, written for the New York Times and The Economist. He's a former practicing lawyer and specializes in media-related copyright, patent, and privacy issues. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Mark.
So you've been over at the UBS conference, and we talked a little bit about what's gone on there with the Netflix CEO, Time Warner CEO, all these big media execs. Seems like a lot of the buzz there has been around the over-the-top video services and just where all the media companies are going to come down. Who's making deals with whom? Are they exclusive deals? What is that? Was that a big part of it, or just kind of a lot of the coverage that came out of it?
Well, I mean, because the Time Warner rhetoric was so colorful. I mean, the CEO has called Netflix in the last year a hamburger. Which army was it? The Albanian army, and they called them a cow and a hamburger and a submarine. And then he came out and called them our friend. So I think that drove a lot of the media buzz around it. But the substance underlying it, I think, is cable is less afraid of Netflix as they were in the past, partly because of Netflix's terrible, terrible year. The cable seems more comfortable with the presence of Netflix around.
Yeah, and then Netflix, I guess, also made this deal with Time Warner for some of their content. So maybe Time Warner's coming around and realizing, hey, if we can make income from this, maybe these guys aren't the evil enemy that we thought before.
Exactly, and with other players coming to the market, I mean, especially, well, I think HBO's success, which is of course a Time Warner subsidiary, with their Go product has been a big success. The arrival of Verizon. So, I mean, I think Netflix doesn't seem nearly as scary as it used to. And also, Netflix, in my opinion, is in a bad position in terms of content. The providers have them over a barrel. In the sense that Netflix doesn't really have any, and they've paid through the nose for House of Cards, and I think they will in the future too. So will they be able to get enough content to be a player 2 years from now?
Hulu's not on the block anymore. Were people talking about Hulu at all? Was that even a big subject there or no?
There wasn't a lot of buzz about Hulu. I'm not sure if you caught it before. My editor Stacey, who's an authority on things like this, her read of it is in Hulu's a very good place in that they're out front. The company's currently undervalued, so why sell now and give up your market position in a business that's going to be booming for the next couple of years?
Was there anything else at the conference that stuck out to you as far as kind of the mood among all these big media players and all these executives? I mean, do they feel like next year is going to be better than this year? I mean, are they in a kind of a positive mood? Are they still worried about the global economy? Where are they in just the mood there?
Well, I think overall there's sort of a buoyancy and an optimism. I mean, aside, unless you're a newspaper, that is, but by and large, yeah, there seems to be a lot of kind of hope and bravado again. Perhaps the prospect of deals in the air that might have just been the bankers talking and hyping it. But yeah, I think overall the mood was very positive. Where the macro economy came up was in terms of cord cutting, because it's still the party line for Time Warner. And HBO and that crowd, that cord cutting is just a function of the macro economy, and that's all going to go away as soon as the economy improves. Which, I mean, read into that what you like, but by and large, the overall mood I would describe as buoyant and optimistic.
So let's talk about a little bit more. Let's shift gears a little bit into something that's more your expertise, which is kind of legal issues. One of the things that's happening now around ebooks, there's this kind of price fixing investigation going on. Apple and the big book publishers were kind of forcing this agency model onto ebooks because they're worried about Amazon kind of undercutting the price of hardbacks and just this $9.99 price that they had. Now we've got an investigation at the EU, and the U.S. Justice Department is also investigating. I mean, how serious do you think this is for Apple and the book publishers?
I think Apple doesn't care. I mean, part of there's related class action suits, and some of them are claiming this is a big conspiracy because Apple had feared Amazon getting content onto their own tablet. And, I mean, I think it's ridiculous. You look at the market share that books represent for Apple. I mean, it's nothing. So, I mean, I don't think Apple cares. They only did this is because they did it with everyone, 30% to play on Apple. So from Apple's point of view, I mean, I think it's irrelevant. The publishers, however, I mean, you got to feel bad for them because they were just getting punished by the ebook market. And unlike video, which is very good at having, or movies, very good at having windows, you know, you've got your prime time and all these different windows. That industry is a master of it. The publishing industry is not quite as nimble, and they're trying to figure out how to window their publications, put out an ebook without undercutting the lucrative sale of hardcovers. So when they saw Amazon selling at under cost to build their market share, they got freaked out in that customers were going to get used to paying $5 for an ebook. So their reaction is understandable. Whether it's legal, we'll see. And keep in mind, though, investigations happen all the time. There's a lot going on we don't even hear about, and some don't, you know, result in anything. The only reason I think we heard from justice was because the Europeans were making a big deal of it.
And in those kind of class action suits, I mean, they usually seem to kind of end up with everyone gets a $2 coupon or something for ebooks or something. I mean, it never seems like that big of a deal, I guess, when it comes down to consumer harm. I feel like we rarely do we get all that much out of it. I guess the lawyers get a big payoff, and the companies need to pay something, but it never seems like that much or that damaging in the end.
Yeah, I mean, well, no, it hurts the companies. I mean, you have to look at it as a business, but it's a business for law firms. They're looking around for something, and someone with deep pockets, publishers, you know, I mean, it's a stretch to say they have deep pockets, but they do relatively. And Apple especially, I mean, they could pay off, you know, the Godfather if they wanted to. So that's what that game's about. If there is a settlement, what'll happen is they'll agree to put, you know, sort of $20 million in a kitty, and everyone who bought an ebook will be entitled to a refund. And if you show up and claim it, you'll get, you know, a credit for $2 for an ebook. The lawyers will take 25% at least, and that's what how it's going to end.
The windowing you mentioned of ebooks, has anybody done any kind of research of whether it's working or how are consumers looking at it and are they happy with it or not?
I think it's still new. People are still wrapping around their head around the idea because, you know, we're all, as consumers, used to the hardcover comes out, the trade paperback comes out, the paperback comes out. The notion of where and when ebooks are going to appear, I think consumers are still a bit puzzled, and I don't think the publishers have mastered it. But certainly people are looking into it.
Well, you really have to change behavior because people want, I mean, they want that book, they want that ebook. I mean, think about the Steve Jobs book. I mean, if we had to wait 2 months to get that on an ebook, you know, people, that would be bizarre to us, the idea that we'd have to wait an amount of time. I mean, it makes sense from a business standpoint to hold off on it, but as far as consumers and what we're used to, I think we're just so used to like that convenience and having it right away.
Yeah, that makes sense too. But publishing is a very conservative industry too, and you've got long-time relationships with sort of, you know, wholesalers and bookstores and stuff like that. And I think they're reluctant to tear it up. Their other big worry too is piracy, because to swap a movie on a BitTorrent system, it still takes a bit of time. You know how tiny a book is in terms of file size, and I mean, books have been pirated for a while, but people are starting to realize that's a quick and easy way to get them. So publishers are freaked out by that fact too.
A last question I have, Jeff, in terms of looking ahead 2012, what do you think with a dominant legal, sort of digital legal issue that you think we'll all be talking about?
It's going to be twofold. One's going to be the ongoing privacy thing. I mean, the FTC, America doesn't have a privacy commissioner. The FTC is stepping into that role using unfair competition. But this year alone, they bagged Facebook and Google for 20-year privacy audits. So keep your eye on that. The other enormous one, the decision's going to come out any day now, is Viacom and YouTube. There's a good chance Viacom's going to lose. But what this is all about is the kind of the content owners strike back. They're sick of safe harbors, which were put into place to help the internet grow and make sure, you know, we could have this robust commercial economy. But now they think that, you know, it's been built on their backs. This isn't a new story, of course, but you
Right.
look at the SOPA legislation. The stuff in the courts is mirroring what's going on in Washington. So it's a full court press in that, okay, look, Google and web hosts and search engines, you've had a free ride long enough. some ways the content owners have a point because there's a lot of websites. DMC takedowns, that's where you, you know, you see infringing content, you send a notice, they take it down. It's a huge pain in the ass to content owners, especially with the proliferation of sites and things like that. So I think 2012 is going to be when we're going to start seeing the legal balance shift a bit towards the content owners, make it easier for them to protect their content.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jeff. That's great. That's really good insight. We'll definitely look out for those cases, and those are things we'll definitely cover in the future, and we'll probably come back to you on those too.
Okay, thanks both of you. It's an honor to be interviewed by you.
So Brian Lamb runs the Wirecutter, a concise site about only the greatest technology, and the Scuttlefish, a site about living near the ocean. He used to run the gadget site Gizmodo and was an editor at Wired Magazine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you guys?
We're doing great. We read through your great gadget guide on Wirecutter, which I thought was really excellent. I mean, it's just getting beyond. There's so much to look at when you get into holiday shopping, and it's always tough to choose. How did you put that together? Was that something just over time you just kind of bookmarked things? How did you do that?
Well, I've been making gift guides for about 10 years of my career, for better or for worse. And the one thing that always struck me was that there are always all these really artificial constraints you have in the magazine world and online world, where, you know, you need to find things that are beautiful on the page and are coming out that quarter and are, you know, easily accessible and found by the masses. But I actually think those things that are the most obvious things are the worst presents. And so I basically just, you know, when I started the site, I decided to make a commitment to doing the most honest advice possible, and saying the most honest thing possible. And it's easy to get away from that, even just getting away from it a hair, and you lose a lot of what you're trying to say. So I basically went through and I found things I thought would be amazing gifts for the people that I care about. And it's a painful process, gift shopping. So, you know, like a lot of good writing, it's just you put your blood into it. So there are a lot of late nights. And the other thing I tried to do was I looked back at my favorite gifts over the last year, and I don't think I'm alone in saying that the things that were made in factories were a lot less loved by me and memorable than the random stuff, even if the random stuff was, you know, cost a dollar. It was just surprising, and I've kept a lot of that. So I tried to reverse engineer the stuff that was surprising. Things, bottles of the whiskey that are, you know, don't cost a lot but are delicious, and you always have amazing memories that go along with your time drinking it, if you can remember them. and, you know, gifts from afar, little handmade things, things that will last a long time, longer than, you know, certainly a cell phone that we might keep 2-3 years. You know, things made out of leather, things that invoked warmth. And it came together really, really great. I'm really happy with it, so I'm glad you appreciate it too.
It's kind of funny to think about gifts and how, you know, there's these two different trends of, like, people obviously love gadgets and getting them, but there's also kind of things like Etsy and handmade gifts and things that are just kind of one of a kind. There's a push towards that too.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that I wouldn't go as far as to say, part of my guide, I say, you know, you shouldn't necessarily get gadgets for gadget people, in most cases, because whenever I've gotten gadgets, it's been really awkward. You know, like someone has gotten me a gadget. If someone has ever get me a camera or a laptop or a tablet, I, you know, A, probably already have it. B, the chances of them getting the one that I particularly want are really slim, you know, except in case of a tablet where everyone's getting an iPad. And, you know, the bar is really high. And also, I don't need more gadgets. So,
You're the last person who should get a gadget, basically.
Yeah, and I actually don't have that many gadgets. I'm probably the gadget writer who has the least amount of technology in my life out of anyone. But, you know, for someone like my mother, I think an iPad would be amazing because it'd be surprising to her.
Yeah, I mean, is that something where a lot of times you want to hear it from the person where they say, "Wow, I really want to have an iPhone or an iPad or something." So you actually they tell you that that's the, you know, it's like you hear them talk about it or something. Like, to me, that makes a big difference than just kind of guessing, "Oh, which cell phone is my girlfriend going to want?"
Yeah, but at the same time, I don't know if that'd be surprising then. And also, like cell phones are always in gift guides, but I can't think of a worse gift. I mean, you're basically saying, I bought you this $200 thing. Oh, by the way, you've got $2,000 to $3,000 worth of contract to pay off over the next 2 years. Hope you like this phone. It's like, you can't get people. I've never seen anyone get anyone a cell phone, so I don't know, have you?
Yeah, I actually did give a cell phone, but it was one of those kind of cheaper Android Metro PCS phones where I knew that's what she wanted.
Ah,
But you're
okay.
right
All
though,
right.
if you're,
Was
you
it, is this
know,
for a spouse? Future
future
spouse.
spouse,
Okay,
yeah.
well, I think that's the one case where it makes sense. That's why I asked. Or if you have children, that definitely makes sense because, you're going to be paying for it through the teenage years.
Brian, so I saw on the site the best e-reader that you mentioned is Amazon Kindle Touch. I'm interested, I'm an Amazon fanboy if there ever was one. What did you th why do you think Amazon F Kindle Fire doesn't deserve to be the one, and why do you think Kindle Touch is supposed to be the one?
I actually recommend both. If you look in the tablet section, I recommend the Fire, but I make a
Oh, I
huge
guess that's true, right?
caveat out there. And the caveat is, if you can get an iPad, get an iPad. But a lot of people in the media have made this huge comparison. I think my theory is that people who write technology stories don't have enough excitement in their lives, so they make these fake battles up between products. It's kind of like when you're a kid and used to play G.I. Joe battles. And I think they used to do, people did Kindle Fire versus iPad, but that's not really a natural, that's like, an elephant versus, a house cat. It's kind of weird. It's because one was designed to be $500 and have all this stuff, and then was designed not compete directly, but to be $200, and I guess compete in that way. But, I think when it comes down to it, the Fire's $200 and it's great, I have one, and it's $200 is widely known by marketers as the impulse buy borderline. So if it's below 200, you don't have to ask your spouse; you can kind of just get away with it. And I certainly bought it for that reason, and I use it as kind of a second tablet in another room, a controller for some of my home automation stuff. I've got both, but if one person could only have one, I'd say get the iPad. But as to your other question, the Kindle, I was really surprised that I didn't pick the cheapest Kindle as my preference, and that's because it's actually too thin, and it's only $20 less than the Kindle Touch. The Kindle Touch has a bigger battery, and it seems to make it easier to hold.
For a longer period of time, I suppose. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. We've gotten to the point where gadgets are getting too thin to hold, but that's the truth. I looked at both of them, and for $20 more, you get double the battery, and you get this really cool thing called X-ray, which is you click on a word, and it brings up all these references and to the word in the rest of the book and to Wikipedia. And so, it's you have that on the touch version. You don't have that powerful thing on the one that's $20 less. So it's pretty much a no-brainer for me.
What about some of the kind of more kind of surprising or off the wall type suggestions that you had in your guide? I mean, what would you suggest for someone who kind of has everything already?
So I think that weird stuff is great, but the best weird stuff is weird stuff with this backstory. Maybe it's me as someone who loves storytelling, but in there I found at the Cooper Hewitt Museum store there was this kazoo trumpet. So it's a trumpet, looks like a trumpet, but really it's just a kazoo with a trumpet shape. And you can imagine how fun that would be, but also annoying and fun. But it's made by the last American metal kazoo maker, apparently there used to be a bunch of them, and this is the last one. And, you know, I think that makes it a lot more interesting. Another one of the weird gifts was this model airplane, which was called the Crow, and its design was figured out by its inventor, I think, in the late 19th century, so, you know, over 100 years ago, by a Japanese inventor who was studying the wing length of a crow in flight. And he made this model plane off of it. And it's one of those rubber band driven, you know, propeller planes. And I thought that was a really cool story too. And so when you hear the stories on objects, they become more than just what they're made of and their shape. It becomes a story. I think that's always a lot more beautiful when it comes to gift giving.
Yeah, the one thing I'm buying right now is going to be the Zojirushi electric kettle. I'm the tea guy, so, and I'm just looking through the guide right now, and I think that's going to be my buy in the next 5 minutes. By the time the show ends,
you're buying stuff as we talk.
Or
what is it? A tea kettle that you're going to get?
Electric water kettle. I mean, I have water kettle. This is my life. My life revolves around a water kettle. So this is where it keeps boiling, and it can dispense it from the top instead of you boiling separate pots every time. So I'm a big.
The other great thing you can do with that kettle is you can set it to boil your water by a certain time in the morning. So you can set it for like 6 a.m. And it'll be ready by the time you wake up.
Nice. That's what I'm going to be doing, because I can't function like a second after I wake up until I have tea.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Brian. Appreciate you joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed talking about stuff.
Yeah, good luck with the sites, and have a great holiday season.
Brian, I do have a last question, not necessarily for the show, but have you been to the Apple, the Grand Central store?
No, I haven't yet.
Okay, Ivan. Are you based in New York? You are, right?
I'm based in San Francisco, actually.
Oh, you are? Okay, for some reason I thought you were there. But anyway, there's so much hype around here, and I live like 5 minutes walk, and I'm dying to go not because I don't want to buy anything.
Where did
it's
they put
inside
it?
Grand Central. Can you believe it? They probably paid like millions, I'm guessing like tens of millions of dollars just to get that space, I'm guessing.
Where do they do it? Because I was just there a bunch of times. I mean, that's actually where I got engaged, but...
Oh, that's oh, where wow. you...
At the
that's where you popped the question?
At the Campbell apartment.
Oh, I don't know where that is, but...
I think the thing that makes it a great place for you to get engaged is the same thing that Apple's going for, you know, that romantic feeling, and it's probably priceless to them. I mean, it's like pennies to them, you know? They've got so much cash.
They got so much cash. This is, if you... It's on one of the sides, if you go up the stairs, it's that whole area that they bought. When you were there, you probably saw a black curtain, and it was behind that. You probably missed.
Oh, wow. What a trip. Yeah, the Campbell apartment is kind of neat. It's just this really hidden away bar that was, I guess, an old tycoon named Campbell had this as like his own little private party spot. And
inside Grand Central?
Yeah, in like the 20s. Wow. And it just became in disrepair. And then in the late 90s, they kind of discovered it and turned it into this kind of, you know, speakeasy style bar that's a very cool spot, and it's hard to find. You have to actually go through another restaurant, out a door, down a stairs, up another stairs. It's like it's very weird when you see it on the you'll see Campbell apartment. The only place it's written is on an exit to Grand Central, so it's it's like,
wow.
It's okay. Very weird. And then when you find it, you feel like you've really stumbled into, like, you're in the 30s or something. It's a very strange kind of place, but really nice. So,
right.
And it's in your neighborhood.
I will. Yes. Well, 5 minutes walk from my place. All right. Thanks, Brian.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Brian.
Thank you, guys.
Take care.
Let me know anytime you want to talk again. Bye.
Okay. Great. Right. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank our co-host Rafat Ali, as well as our special guest Jeff Roberts from Paid Content, as well as Brian Lamb from The Wirecutter, And we want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to stay up with all the news, polls, and events over at PBS MediaShift at pbs.org/MediaShift and our sister site, Idealab, at pbs.org/Idealab. We'll catch you next week.